Do you remember the first time you saw My Darling Clementine?
I saw it in 1946.
When it came out.
With my mother, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Dave says, he saw it in 1946. But what you never forget that last scene.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with James Lee Burke about The New Iberia Blues, his 22nd novel in the Dave Robichaux mystery series. James Lee Burke is a philosopher, historian, cinephile, comic, master storyteller, and gentleman of the old school. The last scene in My Darling Clementine echoes a part of your book.
Yeah.
Right? The character says, I sure like the name Clementine.
Oh, yeah.
And then in your book, Dave has this fondness for a female, Bailey Ribbons.
Yeah, Bailey Ribbons is a great character.
Tell me about her. And she has a dark past, too.
Yeah. Bailey Ribbons is a young woman detective who joins the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Department at detective grade. And so she's resented by some of the male members there who have been there much longer. But the peculiarity in Bailey, who's educated, she has a degree in police science and in psychology. She's different in another way. Number one, she reminds Dave Robichaux of Clementine Carter, the character in John Ford's great movie, My Darling Clementine. But secondly, there's a dark incident that occurred in her past. And without giving away too much, it has to do with her being a young woman. You know, she was still in her teens. She was traveling with the rodeo in the carnival, and she trusted the wrong people. And they did enormous injury, but she paid them back in kind.
Yes.
And Dave knows that she has a harrowing history of some kind, but he doesn't know what it is. What Dave struggles with is not so much the individual incidents, but the fact that there seems to be a pathology in some kinds of people for whom we have no explanation.
Yes.
And, of course, childhood trauma is the favorite term today. I don't think that works. It's just, for me, it's not convincing. Mm-hmm. The childhood trauma does not equate with the rage of the amount of it that these people visit on others.
Yes.
Like Dave brings out the several famous killers, like
right.
BTK and the Menendez brothers, the Hillside Stranglers in Los Angeles, people for whom there is no explanation.
Right. I was so struck by the references you make to evil, and you write, baptized Christians ran the ovens in the camps.
That's it.
And that evil has an odor. It's a presence that consumes its host. We deny it because we don't have an acceptable explanation. It smells like decay inside living tissue.
Mm-hmm.
What's your fascination with trying to understand this yourself?
Well, I believe it's in our midst every day. We just find ways to cosmetically remove it from either our memory or we also avoid certain conclusions that can make us very uncomfortable about our own not only inability to deal with it, but to recognize it honestly for what it is. I remember years ago, this was 1961, I did some work inside Angola Prison in Louisiana. And Angola was a bad place. I don't know what it's like today, but it was a bad place back then. And I was convinced, another man and I recorded a number of musicians on the farm. So we had access to all the farms, the lockdown units, and we we talked to many inmates and recorded them. And the guards were always with us. But the point is, the things we saw and heard there convinced me that, without a doubt, if we ever had a Third Reich in this country, the people that we were talking to, not the criminals, I'm talking about the personnel, in a blink, they would work in a place like Auschwitz. Yes. That's not exaggeration. Right. And I never tell people about what I saw and what I heard there. It's too awful.
Yes.
And it shocks people's sensibilities.
Right.
But it was the way they talked in front of us about what they did, the way they treated men of color.
Yeah.
I knew the fellow who was in the same barracks, prison barracks, as Leadbelly, Hudie Leadbelly.
Yeah.
I was his
yeah.
caseworker, actually. I'm sure he did 42 years. I remember what he told me. I asked him, I said, what kind of fellow was Leadbelly? He said, he was like a rattlesnake. He'd rattle once, but the second time, he said, you better
watch out. Hearing you talk, I can just feel being in the book and what Dave grapples with and the references to suicide, you know, that someday Dave might paint the walls or eat his gun.
Yeah.
And so I want to know, how does Dave and how do you, Jim, how do you stay afloat? What keeps you anchored in a sense of light?
Well, I think ultimately the question we all ask ourselves that, I mean, anyone who lives what Socrates called the examined life has to address certain questions. How do we reconcile the existence of God, a merciful God, with the fact that both good and evil coexist in the world in which we live? And so that seems to me the most serious philosophic or metaphysical question that every thinking person confronts.
Yes.
And so I think it ultimately there is an answer. And you know, the person, I've read a fair amount theological books, but I think the best writer about theological questions of this sort was Norman Mailer, because he was a believer. He's had a concept of God that he wrote about it in an essay. And he said that the answer ultimately is that we are God's helpers. He said there are those who serve the forces of light and goodness and those who have an agenda, and it's to turn the earth into a gravel pit. Mm-hmm. But he said we have to think of ourselves as the light bearers.
This makes me think of the blues.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and you have this blues singer, Bella, and she says to Dave, "You learn the blues at the crossroads, darling."
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, we soothe ourselves. We listen to Leadbelly, you know, like, right?
Yeah, that's it. And of course, you know, supposedly Robert Johnson learned the blues at the crossroads and lost his soul, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You dedicate this book to Julian Higgins,
yeah.
who you call a poet with a movie camera.
Yeah.
What's your connection to him?
Well, he's a young movie director. He's only 32 years old, but he has enormous talent. And he directed an adaptation of a short story I wrote titled Winter Light. It is a great, great movie. It was in the top 10 nominations for short films for the Academy Award, but it didn't make it.
Wow.
But Julian is extremely talented, and now he's enlarging that film into a two-hour theatrical release. Yeah, but he's a very talented young guy.
And how did you know that you wanted to have the film industry be such a prominent theme and environment in the book?
Oh, it's film industry is the most fascinating culture in the world. I don't know why people constantly denigrate it.
Yeah.
It's America's secular cathedral, and it was created here. Yeah. Here's what's just really, to me, mind-blowing. If you visit the set or you're around a little while and kind of meet everyone, you discover that you've got this disparate group of people. I mean, guys that, and I mean this with all respect because it applies to writers more so probably even than actors. Here are people who just got kicked out of the Foreign Legion, who just got out of electroshock. They've still got scorch marks on their temples. They were kicked out of detox in the methadone clinic. And you've got, at any given time, there are over 100 people behind the camera.
Right.
And so you've got all these dysfunctional people who glow in the dark with neurosis, and they make movies like Gone with the Wind and The Godfather. You know, my heavens, how does this happen? And the answer is no one knows. But no, if there's any American art form, it's motion pictures.
Yes.
Anyone who doesn't like movies has a serious spiritual disorder. Have you ever had this experience? You're talking to someone you don't know very well, and you say something about a movie, and it's, did you see certain, so did you see The Godfather, or whatever? And the person says, oh, no, we don't go to movies much. Right. And you say, gee, holy moly, I got to run. I'm supposed to be color matching my socks this evening. I'll see you later.
Right.
Because there's something wrong.
There's a deficit
with this person.
What films influence your writing life the most?
Well, I think one is My Darling Clementine. Yeah. I've seen it over and over again. And this is my perception, the best film I've ever seen is The Godfather 1. Mm-hmm. Every scene is a short story. It's like the Canterbury Tales.
Oh, yeah.
And every scene would stand on itself. And also, it's the method that's used to take the scene, one scene to the next, without any transition. And the most powerful scene, the one that nobody ever forgets, is the baptism scene, when Michael's baby is being baptized and people are being killed all over New York City. This is the story. The scene was not working. The director, Coppola, wanted to create the juxtaposition between the baptism of the baby and the killing of all of Don Corleone or Michael's enemies. And it was Puzo, the writer, who said, use the organ music. Uh-huh. Bleed the sound of the organ in the church into the murder scenes. Yeah. And it was a brilliant stroke. Uh-huh. But every scene in that film, you can watch the people in the background. There's a story behind a story, but it's a masterpiece. It's just nothing like it. Do you know, though, when it was completed, no one thought it was going anywhere, and they didn't make many prints. And the first night it opened around the country, second night, the theaters were absolutely packed.
Yes.
I remember we saw it the second night it played in Fort Lauderdale, and you couldn't get in the theater. And the producers had to quickly make more prints.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with James Lee Burke. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So what's the lesson for artists here? You know, like, how
Never
do you
quit.
Know? Yeah, okay. How
Never
do you know
quit.
When to believe in your work or not?
That's it. Okay. That's a great question. And I taught creative writing in a number of schools. And they were all great kids. But once in a while, somebody would come up to me and say, hey, Jim, do you think I've got it? Do you think I've got the talent? Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say anything. Because if he asked the question, he was following the wrong flag.
Right.
That's it. You'd never doubt it. You don't care whether people think you're talented or not. And every writer, every artist knows the following. The gift comes from somewhere outside oneself. And everyone knows it. Everyone, the most arrogant and narcissistic, neurotic, self-centered individual in the world who has talent knows that if he takes credit for it, it will be taken from him
yes.
and given to someone else. I have yet to see it fail. The worst pronouns in the world for a writer are I, me, my, mine, and myself. It's my feeling that humility is not a virtue for an artist. It is a necessity.
Yes.
That arrogance and pride are just absolute murder. My wife, Pearl, and I were on the circuit, as it's called, for 15 years. And we were doing up to 35 cities a year.
Wow.
So we got to know just about everybody in the writing
right.
community. And they're all good people. I mean, you don't have bad experiences in the book business. I mean, once in a while you meet a pill, but very often. but this was my experience, that the people who take themselves less seriously tend to be crime and mystery writers.
Yeah.
And they're really good guys. It's just really a nice community.
Yes.
Did you meet Lee Child?
I sure did. He stole my punchline for a joke I had.
Oh, really?
And I thought, this guy's great.
He's a gentleman of the old school. He is the real deal.
What is a gentleman of the old school? What is the old school?
Oh, yes. Just, okay, great question.
Educate me.
Look, Pearl and I went to BoucherCon. You know, it's a big crime writing conference
yeah.
in Vegas, and we were guest of honor because I received an award there. Our daughter, Alifair, was
yes.
there. She's the
yes.
novel, Alifair Burke. Alifair had to leave one day early, and so she got on a plane there and was flying back, she thought, to Kennedy Airport. Instead, she discovered in mid-flight she got on the wrong plane and she was going to be dropped at LaGuardia.
Right.
Miles, many miles, at 2 in the morning.
Ugh.
And she was still a little tyke then. So she was sitting there just really in the dumps, and she said there was this handsome-looking fellow about 3 seats in front of her, and she said, she went over and looked, and she said, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but I saw you having dinner with my mother and father 2 nights ago.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, yes, I'm Lee Child, and I'm a great admirer of your parents, and obviously you're Miss Alifair Burke, and your manners and your just lovely smile could only indicate one thing. You're the child of Miss Pearl Burke and her fine husband, Mr. James Burke.
Yes.
And Alifair said, Mr. Child, I think I'm going to cry because I'm going to end up in the Bronx at 2 in the morning. He said, you shall not end up in the Bronx at 2 in the morning because I have my limo and my driver at your disposal, and we will take you immediately to your apartment in Greenwich Village. So worry not about anything. Would you care for a drink? That's old school, but that's Lee Child. He is a fine fellow.
One of the things I love so much about this book is at one point you write, every literary plot is either the Bible, Greek mythology, or Elizabethan theater.
That's it.
And you also, you reference Freud. You say, nobody listens to Freud anymore, or
yeah.
one of your characters
yeah.
does. And you have, you know, even this Jungian stuff about shadow and light.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so clear. You're pulling from all the sources. Tarot cards, the Bible.
Here's the advantage in having a classical education. No one else has one anymore.
Right. It's so true.
And so it's all new. And so I've been stealing plots from and characters from the Bible for 60 years, and no one has noticed. The only problem is I think I might be in trouble up the track.
Sitting here with you, I feel so comforted to know that there's someone who retains sanity and perspective and immense grief about where we are.
Yeah.
And that feels like Dave. Dave is like full of grief.
Yeah. But you know what Dave says in this book, you know, at the end, he says, Cleet, Purcell, and I will never change the earth or the world. By the same token, it will never change us.
Yes.
And that's it.
Okay.
That's it. And you never let evil, the shadow, you know,
right.
Fall across your life. You you never substitute the darkness of others, of evil men, for the light that's always available to us. But these kinds of people, though, always destroy themselves.
Yeah.
It's like flame inside a wax container, mm-hmm. and there's a black flame in everyone. It's in their eyes. There's some of them, I'm absolutely convinced, that men of enormous power that I'm convinced are evil. They're war criminals, and they're evil, and it's in their eyes. There's a dark luster in them that just, to me, it's like black electricity.
You finish a couple chapters with these lines from Dave's perspective that just barreled through me. And one of them is, Dave says or thinks, I wanted to be on the other side of the moon.
Yeah.
And he also thinks, I wanted to take out my vocal cords.
Yeah.
What did he say about his personality or his approach?
Dave,
yeah.
when he says these, makes these remarks, yeah. because he's felt that his lack of reticence at a very delicate moment has done injury to others.
Yeah.
And it bothers him because Dave has a moments where he goes into this non-chemically induced blackout and bad things happen. And of course, it's because of the childhood he had.
Yeah.
And he's capable of just ripping bad guys apart. But it hurts him when he realizes he's done injury to another because of a careless word. It turns him against himself, but that's it. I think maybe it's because, you know, it's a funny thing that we oftentimes forget the power we have to do good or evil just on an everyday level. That a smile at a person who's having a bad day can make an enormous difference.
Yeah.
To be willing to listen to someone's problem, mm-hmm. or to be self-centered and irritable and condescending and hurt someone. And we never know. Maybe it's like a stone bruise to that
yeah.
person.
Yeah. I want you to read something and then...
Okay. This passage seems to be about Louisiana in general and the New Iberia area in particular, but in effect it's not. Dave Robichaux is really talking about the larger society and some of the choices that we have made. And sometimes the temptation in a emotional moment to make choices that can be irreversible. My speculations probably seem grandiose. In reality, I wasn't talking about our local homicides. I believe then, and I believe now, that our poor, suffering state is part of a historical ebb tide that few people recognize as such. Southern Louisiana, as late as the Great Depression, retained many of the characteristics of the antediluvian world, untouched by the industrial age. Our coast was defined by its pristine wetlands. They were emerald green and dotted with hummocks and flooded tupelo gums and cypress trees and serpentine rivers and bayous that turned yellow after the spring rains and lakes that were both clear and black because of the fine silt at the bottom. All of it blanketed with snowy egrets and blue herons and seagulls and brown pelicans. We had little money but didn't think of ourselves as poor. Our vision, if I can call it that, was not materialistic. If we had a concept about ourselves, it was egalitarian, although we would not have known what that word meant. We spoke French entirely. There was a bond between Cajuns and people of color. Cajuns didn't travel because they believed they lived in the best place on earth. But somehow the worst in us, or outside of us, asserted itself and prevailed and replaced everything that was good in our lives. We traded away our language, our customs, our stands of cypress, our sugarcane acreage and identity and our pride. Outsiders ridiculed us and thought us stupid. Teachers forbade our children to speak French on the school grounds. Our barrier islands were dredged to extinction. Our coastline was cut with 8,000 miles of industrial channels, destroying the root systems of the sawgrass and the swamps. The bottom of the state continues to wash away in the flume of the Mississippi at a rate of 16 square miles a year. Much of this we did to ourselves in the same way that a drunk like me will destroy a gift, one that is irreplaceable and extended by a divine hand. Our roadsides are littered with trash, our rain ditches layered with it, our waterways dumping grounds for automobile tires and couches and building material. While we trivialize the implications of our drive-through daiquiri windows and the seediness of our politicians and recite our self-congratulatory mantra, laissez le bon temps rouler, the southern rim of the state hovers on the edge of oblivion. A diminishing, heartbreaking strip of green lace that eventually will be available only in photographs. That afternoon, Alifair asked if Cleet and I wanted to take a trip to northern Arizona. Cleet said he'd pass. I said, why not?
James Lee Burke was born in Houston in 1936, 10 years before My Darling Clementine was released. He grew up on the Texas-Louisiana Gulf Coast and published his first story at age 19. Burke is the author of 37 novels and two short story collections. He's been a Breadloaf and Guggenheim Fellow and has been awarded two Edgar Awards for Best Novel. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org. where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bethann Austin studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.